Hey there, I'm Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked into the middle of the 13th canto of Purgatorio. We are far along into Dante's second canticle of his major work comedy. We have come to the second terrace. We have found out that this is the terrace of the envious, or those who are penitent for their envy. And we are slowly... Wow, really slowly approaching one of the penitents. I know I've been setting her up for episode after episode, and she's still not going to make an appearance here, though this is where she's going to get called for. She is such an important figure that I think that we have to think about how the delay works in Canto 13. The constant and incessant delay for both how the penitents are punished, or how they are, punished is not the right word, but how they are purgated with their eyes sewn shut, that huge delay up to that payoff, and now this huge delay to the payoff of one of the greatest figures in all of Dante's work, comedy. This is my English translation of the medieval Florentine. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can print it off. You can make your own notes. You can copy it. You can do as you like. Better yet, you can continue the conversation with me. And I very much appreciate the remarks that have been made recently about Purgatorio, because this is tough stuff. And we are walking slowly, and sometimes tough, slow walks are the hardest of them all. We're going to take it as it comes. Line 73 through 93 of Canto 13 of Purgatorio. Here it is. It seemed to me, while walking on, that I made some sort of transgression in passing by them without then being seen by them. That's why I turned back around to my wise advisor. He knew full well what my mute self wanted to say. He didn't, therefore, hold back to await my question, but said, "Speak, and cut it short, and be clear." Virgil was coming along a little behind me, but on the side of the terrace where one would be able to fall right off, since it wasn't engarlanded with embankments. On my other side were the devout shades, who, through their horrid sutures, eked out tears that bathed their cheeks. I turned back to them and began, "O people secure of seeing the light on high, the one that's the only rationale for your desire, so that grace may quickly rinse off the crud on your conscience, and so that the river of your mind may make a crystal clear descent through it, let me know if there's an Italian spirit among you, for it would be as both grace and charity to me, and it's probably best if I learn from that sort." See, I told you we're going to get right up to her. We want to work through this passage. We want to talk a little bit about this weird idea of the gaff, of a social gaff that's going on in the early three lines. We want to talk about Virgil's rather curt response and the way that curt response works in terms of Virgil's position in Purgatorio. We want to talk also about the problems of allegory and naturalism one more time before we finally hit this long bit of flattery from Dante the Pilgrim toward the penitents to try to get one of them to speak. Let's get started. The first three lines, lines 73 through 75, are, "It seemed to me, while walking on, that I made some sort of transgression in passing by them without then being seen by them. That's why I turned back around to my wise advisor." Let's just stop right here. We remember that their eyes are sewn shut, or their eyelids are sewn shut, with metal wire. And they're sitting there in probably painful agony in their hair shorts, which are livid, a bluish-gray color, the same color as the stone around them. So they can't see Dante, and they can't see Virgil, but they probably can sense someone's walking along. And this brings up this problem of a social gaffe. It seemed to me while walking along that I made some sort of offense or transgression, as if I'm sneaking past them, or as if I'm going along by them and they can't see me and I know that, but I'm not acknowledging that I'm here and they can probably, well, hear me. I don't know. Can the shades smell? I don't know. Smell me. They can certainly hear my footfall. So I'm making some kind of gaffe. Now, let's just say, first of all, that this is set up as a little bit of hesitation. It seemed to me that's right there in the medieval Florentine. So it's not that I am making a transgression or a gaffe, but I felt as if I were making one. We've never really had a moment in which Dante expresses this kind of relationship to the manner code, to being polite. I think there are two things that we can notice. One, we'd have to wait for a while for it to pay off, but one is paying off currently. The one that we have to wait for to pay off is this notion that envy has something to do with the social contract amongst humans, that we humans together make a social compact. I'm getting a little Rousseauian, but okay, let me have it. Envy in some way violates that social contract. This will pay off much more in the rest of this canto and then in canto 14 ahead of us. And this is a little setup. I think that we are really used to this by this point. Dante sets up what's ahead, but there is another way that this is paying off for something we're already talking about, and that is the sense of alienation. Walking past these blind people and, you know, making noise, your footsteps on the stone, you know, but going past them and they can't see them, it does increase the alienation. And we've been talking about that here, that somehow I'm giving offense by even walking by them. It all adds up to this intersection of envy and alienation, the way that the two are cross-currented. The more we think about that, the more we can see it. The more we can see it happening in the world around us, the more we can see it playing out in the politics around us, especially at the current moment across Western politics, the way that envy itself in an increasingly socially inequitous society, much like Dante's, in fact, breaks the social contract and leads to a personal level of alienation. And I think that gets expressed for us here early on in this passage. Let's pass on to the next tercet. Starting at line 76, Virgil knew full well what my mute self wanted to say. He didn't therefore hold back to await my question, but said, "Speak and cut it short and be clear." A couple things here. One, the blind can't see Dante. The blind can't see his facial reactions. They can't see that he's hesitant, that he thinks he's maybe giving offense by walking by them without saying anything. So, you know, Virgil knows that they can't see him, and he's saying, hey, you know, cut it out. Stop playing games. Just talk to them. But there's another bit here, and that is the curt nature of Virgil's speech. This is the last time Virgil will speak until almost the end of Canto 14. He will disappear from the action until Canto 14, line 143. We'll have to talk more and more about this, but this is part of the increasing silence of Virgil in Purgatorio. There will come long stretches where Virgil doesn't seem to be present. Why? That's the $50 million question. Because Dante's having problems placing him there, because he doesn't have anything to say about this part of the afterlife. Although that's not true. Because although the silences from Virgil will start getting longer and longer in Purgatorio, we're about to hit one of his longest and most important speeches just beyond the Terrace of the Envious. So, yes, he is in for much more silence, but he's also in for much more speech when he does, in fact, talk, with this exception. And it's hard not to read this line as a little bit irritated. I think that Virgil is probably saying, hey, we've been through enough territory together that you know what you have to do. If you're going to talk to these people, you got to talk to them, and you got to quit pussyfooting around and acting like you're doing something wrong. This is why we're here, buddy, is to walk across the known universe. So speak up. Don't hold back. And then that leads us out to 9 very curious lines. Virgil was coming along a little behind me, but on the side of the terrace where one would be able to fall right off. You should know that there's a translation decision I made there. The medieval Florentine really just says Virgil was coming along, but on the side of the terrace, and I added that a little behind me. There seems to be a notion that if Virgil is coming, then he's slightly behind Dante. When they're going, they're together. If he's coming, he's just a little bit over Dante's shoulder. So I added that bit along a little behind me. It may or may not be important depending on how you interpret the passage, but he is coming along behind me, but on the side of the terrace where one would be able to fall right off. So Virgil's out on the edge. He's at the farthest point from the cliff wall. You could fall right off. Since it wasn't, and this is such a beautiful word even in the medieval Florentine, engarlanded with any embankments or turrets or safekeeping guardrails. It didn't have anything there like an embankment, a berm, a tower, anything to keep you from falling off. And it's a beautiful word, engarlanded. It's got a gorgeous texture to it. And yet at the same time, Virgil is capable of falling. We are dropped the hint that Virgil could fall right off this thing. Let's just drop that for a second and move on in the passage. On my other side were the devout shades who, through their horrid sutures on their eyelids, eked out tears that bathed their cheeks. Just keep that word bathed in mind for a moment. I turned back to them and began, O people secure of seeing the light on high, the one that's the only rationale for your desires. And then he goes on. We're going to break it right there. Here's why we're going to break it. These lines are so wildly naturalistic and allegorical at the same time. Virgil is walking on the edge of the terrace, and he could fall off. And he's just offered a prayer, and my interpretation, a pagan prayer to the sun. Virgil is in danger of falling off this part of the afterlife, which would make his position here allegorical, which would bring us back to the allegory of the sun. But then Dante doesn't make it easy on us, because Dante says, I turned back to them and said, O people secure of seeing the light on high. What is he talking about? The one that's the only rationale for your desires. Whoa, that seems like he's talking about God, but their eyes are stitched shut. So is it the natural sun, the real sun up in the sky, or is it an allegorical vision of the sun, or is it both? Is this a beautiful natural detail about Virgil, or is this telling us something about Virgil's position in this part of the afterlife? He could fall right off. Or is it, in fact, that Virgil is protecting Dante? He's stationing himself at the edge to form the embankment that is missing, to form the guardrail that is missing. Remember, he did the same thing on Garion's back. He sat behind Dante the Pilgrim in order to protect Dante from Garion's tail as they flew down to the 8th circle of hell. Is that what's going on here? These lines always make me laugh. I can't help but laugh out loud because they are so weirdly naturalistic, allegorical all at the same moment. And we've been dancing around this allegory problem for a long time. I like to think that Dante the poet is laughing up his sleeve, that he knows he's setting us up for the sun as an allegory, and yet at the same time he keeps shifting it back and forth from the naturalistic to the allegorical. Here these people are blinded, they can't see the sun in the sky. We know the sun is up because Virgil looked right at it, and yet it's the only rationale for their desires. Well, in Dante's theology, that's God, so suddenly it's not that sun that's up in the sky. It's a lovely bit of play on Dante's part, and I like that. There is so much complication here. Virgil as protector, Virgil as possible victim falling off the edge, the sun as the light that guides them, the sun that is shut off from the envious, the sun that is an allegory of God and the desire for God. all of that is in play in a complicated passage. When you first blow through this, it seems relatively easy, but the more you think about it, the more you think how complicated this emotional space is. That is why comedy is worth a slow walk. Let's go on to the last 9 lines. In order to do that, I'm going to have to carry on with 3 of the lines we just were at. So I'm going to start at line 85. I turned back to them and began, "O people secure of seeing the light on high, the one that's the only rationale for your desires, so that grace may quickly rinse off the crud on your conscience, and so that the river of your mind may make a crystal clear descent through it, let me know if there's an Italian spirit among you, for it would be both grace and charity to me, and it's probably best if I learn from that sort." There's a long, long history here in commentary about Dante's flattery. Many, especially of the early commentators, but even some modern commentators, think that Dante is completely overdoing it, that he is just laying it on so thick here to try to get one of them to speak. And mostly in purgatory, they're willing to speak. In the depths of hell, they seem more reticent to be known. Purgatory, no problems. So why is Dante laying it on quite so thick, this flattery? And you should know that there's a long tradition of asking the question, how ironic is this? Is Dante, trying to overdo it because Virgil has been so curt? Speak and cut it short and be clear. Well, this is not cutting it short. This is 9 lines of flattery. The last thing this is being brief. Is Dante laying it on thick because he somehow sees himself as above the envious in some way? There are critics who do read that Dante himself is not guilty of the sin of envy. He's guilty of other sins. And so his only sin here, transgression, is the social gaffe of walking by them without saying anything. But he himself is not necessarily subjected to envy. And we'll see that actually stated more outright ahead of us in the passage. Is that why he's laying it on so thick? Because he's kind of got this condescending attitude toward them? It's all very difficult to figure out. We can say that this is a strategy we've seen before in comedy. The name for this strategy, the rhetorical strategy, is captatio benevolentiae, a benevolent gesture to cause you to respond to me. I flatter you enough, and you'll come back with some kind of answer to me. And this is a standard rhetorical feature. And guess what? We've seen this before. Guess where? In Inferno 13, as well as other places. But Inferno 13, remember, they're walking through the Wood of the Suicides. Virgil says, break off a twig. And Dante does. And when Dante breaks off a twig, which happens to be the metamorphosized Pierre de la Vigne, when he does that, of course, the blood spurts out and Pierre de Vigne groans in pain and says, how come you're doing this to me? And Virgil makes this big thing of, I had to make the pilgrim do this because otherwise he wouldn't believe what he's seeing of the suicides turned into trees. And then guess what? Virgil himself engages in a little captatio. He says to Pierre, now tell him who you were, so that by way of recompense he may revive your fame up in the world where he's permitted to return. He's flattering Pierre to get him to talk because Pierre's in pain because he's been broken. Interesting that this kind of flattery occurs in 2 places, Canto 13 of Inferno and Canto 13 of Purgatorio, to try to get someone to speak. And interestingly there that it's Virgil and here it's Dante, and this one is much more, shall we say, fulsome? It's much bigger, and it's a much longer bit of flattery. All of that is quite curious, and you can see how then that leads some critics to say, this is ironic. I have to tell you, just to lay my cards on the table, I don't read this as ironic. I read this as a kind of setup for the verbal jousting that's ahead of us. And the pilgrim is showing us that he is well-versed in the techniques of rhetoric, and believe me, he's going to need it for the person who lies right in front of him. inside of this flattery, there is just gorgeous poetry. He says, you know, you're secure in seeing the light, the only rational for your desires, and so that grace may quickly rinse off the crud on your conscience. Rinse. Remember what their tears are doing? Bathing their cheeks. There's so much water imagery here, and then this line that just knocks me out. And so that the river of your mind may make a crystal clear descent through it. What is being purified here is the intellect, the mind. There's two different things here that we should focus on. One is something that's way ahead of us, and Dante's dropping the seeds way before we get there. And I hate doing this because it's in some way says, oh, see, I've already read it, so I know it's ahead. When we get to the top of Purgatorio, there is going to be the beautiful garden. And in the garden are going to be two rivers, Lethe and a river Dante himself just makes up out of whole cloth. And here we see two different actions of river dipping or cleansing with water, just as we'll get dipped in two rivers up at the top of Purgatorio. The rinsing off of the crud on your conscience, and then the place in which you're dipped so that the river of your mind can make a crystal clear descent through it, so that your mind clarifies, your intellect clarifies. The word here is mente, and it could mean memory, so that the river of your memories make a crystal clear descent through it. A lot of critics translate it as memory because the river above will help you to clarify your memory, to rid you of bad memories. Not only rid you of the crud on your conscience, but also the bad memories that you carry with you. That's the river that Dante makes up. Okay, so they're kind of, they're given a precursor here. We're given a little foreshadowing of what's ahead. If we read Purgatorio, we know they're ahead. Dante, the poet, can know they're ahead. That they're in Dante the Pilgrim's mouth is a little troubling, because how does he know that there are two ways of getting washed off? Does he intuit it? Is this a moment in which the poet and the pilgrim kind of fuse into one thing? Maybe. But what we can say is that there is a lot of water here, tears bathing cheeks, rinsing off the crud, river of the mind. We can't help but think of baptism. We can't help think of being made clean in the Christian theology of baptism. And we can't help but notice just how gorgeous this poetry is. This reminds me of that moment in Inferno 1 when the lake of the heart, the turbulent waters on the lake of the heart are stilled. This is just as gorgeous a moment for me. So the river of your mind may make a crystal clear descent through your conscience, through yourself, through your innermost being. It's so hopeful. It's so beautiful. It so expresses the very best of what we all hope would eventually happen, that the river of our mind or our memories can make a crystal clear descent through our inner selves. One last little bit of strangeness in the passage. Dante finishes off by saying, "Let me know if there's any Italian spirit among you, for it would be as both grace and charity to me if, you know, if I could talk to somebody who's," he actually uses the word Latina. We'll talk about this in a minute. So Latin spirit, we would in modern parlance say Italian. You know, there's no Italian nation as we now know it in Dante's day. So people who speak Italian, this kind of peninsular group of people who are in various political configurations. But what's interesting here is, as I said, he uses the word Latina. Now, he uses a feminine word, Latina, because he's talking about anima, spirit. So in order, in grammatical sense, in order for it to make sense, he's got to say Latina for anima to make sense of the thing. But Latina is sitting there by itself in the line. And you could say, let me know if there's any Italian woman ahead of me. It's a little bit of funny play. It's a little bit of irony on Dante's part. I can't help but think he's playing with grammatical gender, knowing that there's a woman right ahead of him, and now asking, hey, is there any Latina right up ahead of me? Again, Latina is there because of anima. It has to grammatically agree, but it allows for a little irony in the text. And I think that's what this whole passage has done. it has allowed for a little irony. Whether you take that flattery as irony, whether you take Dante's position as irony, whether you take Virgil's speech as way too curt, whether you take Virgil falling off the mountain as irony, especially after the prayer for the sun, there's just a little bit of irony here, a little texture. And I think that texture is what makes the passage so fascinating and what makes Purgatorio so fascinating. And why is it best if he learns from that sort? Is it because Virgil was so curt, so direct, so abrupt above? Does Dante hope for a more genteel answer? Are we back to the social contract? I'm not sure, but what I am sure of is the texture. It's as if, how do I say this? We're not dealing with cotton, with pressed cotton. We're dealing with woven, loomed tapestry. And we can feel that texture between our fingers. Pressed cotton is really nice, admittedly, right? It's beautiful. But there's also something really satisfying about woven texture when you feel it between your fingers. And I think that's what the irony gives us here. It's just texture in the passage, beautifully done. One more time, a reading of this passage, Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 73 through 93. It seemed to me, while walking on, that I made some sort of transgression in passing by them without then being seen by them. That's why I turned back around to my wise advisor. He knew full well what my mute self wanted to say. He didn't, therefore, hold back to await my question, but said, "Speak, cut it short, and be clear." Virgil was coming along a little behind me, but on the side of the terrace where one would be able to fall right off, since it wasn't engarlanded with any embankments. On my other side were the devout shades, who, through their horrid sutures, eked out tears that bathed their cheeks. I turned back to them and began, "Oh, people secure of seeing the light on high, the one that's the only rationale for your desires, so that grace may quickly rinse off the crud of your conscience, and so that the river of your mind may make a crystal clear descent through it. Let me know if there's an Italian spirit among you, for it would be as both grace and charity to me. And it's probably best if I learn from that sort." Thanks for listening to this episode of Walking with Dante. I hope that it has brought out some of what is incredibly important to see here, and that is Dante is not working on a flat plane. He's working in three dimensions. I don't know, maybe four dimensions, maybe five dimensions. We can see both the Orthodox theology going on as he approaches the penitence, but we can also see the textures of irony inside the passage. And this is part of what makes Dante such a fantastic poet. He is, without a doubt, a true believer. And yet at the same time, that status as true believer allows him to play with irony. To get more of this, you should subscribe to this podcast. If you can, rate it. That would be terrific. It really helps in the algorithms. I know, as I always say, that's not your problem. It's mine, but hey, it does help. And otherwise, come back, because at long last, I promise, in the next episode, we will meet this shade who's hanging out here right in front of Dante the Pilgrim and Virgil. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I'll see you then.